Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon, and it's time for a podcast. This is going to be an interesting one. Today, we are interviewing Michael Bird and Brad Adato. These are the dynamic co-founders and legal visionaries behind Legal 123. This is one of the leading law firms that specializes in aesthetic medicine law. Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We're super excited to be here.
Yeah, we're excited. Thanks, Dr. K.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. Let's start with Michael. I know you're a seasoned attorney. You've been in healthcare legislation and corporate law for a long time. But Michael, what makes you interested in aesthetic law?
So my dad's a plastic surgeon. And when I started practicing law in 1995, my dad and his partners here in Dallas kept calling me and giving me pet projects. And I think they just wanted someone they could trust because I had no clue what I was doing. And they were extremely patient with me. What I found was that I was really interested in the business side of medicine, that there weren't really many attorneys anywhere that focused on representing doctors on the business side. And so it quickly became a passion that formed, you know, the basis of my entire career. And I know, Brad, you kind of had the same thing happening with you in New Orleans.
Yeah, similar. My dad being an orthopedic surgeon. So growing up with the doctors around me, I knew right away I did not want to be a doctor. So I figured that one out pretty quickly. Being blessed, being surrounded by lots of different physicians, realizing that they had a need to be represented, just like Michael said, and it was an easy win for me to step into that calling.
Amazing. Well, my dad was a head and neck surgeon, so there you guys are. We were all three raised by doctors.
Yes, and technically, Dr. K, we're all doctors here. We're just juris doctors. So, you know, if you want to call us Dr. Adato and Dr. Bird, you can. But we probably be looking over our shoulders looking for a dad still.
Exactly.
Well, that brings us to an interesting legal question. In the state of California in January 2024, they're proposing that nurse practitioners can become independent providers without the supervision of a physician. So what are your guys' thoughts on that? Have we seen that done in other states successfully? Is California going to have a lot of problems?
Yes, it has been done in other states. What's going to happen in California is that they're releasing the law passed a while ago, and then they're releasing the rules that go with it. And there actually are a lot of hoops to jump through for a nurse practitioner to actually become fully independent. And part of it is, I'm going off memories, they have to be a part of working side by side with a physician for some period of time. I think it's a couple of years. And so it makes, in a lot of scenarios, the ability for a nurse practitioner to become independent really difficult, especially if they're working in a medical spa where there's not a physician present in the practice. What we've found kind of more broadly across the country with this movement is that a law gets passed and everyone thinks, oh, okay, it's black and white. This is what happens next. And they don't realize that the passing of the law is like the first thing, and the details that will follow sometimes take years to be ironed out. And just as an example, they may be independent, but does that mean they're going to be allowed to own their own medical spa or medical practice? And that's to be determined, because that's a whole different area of the code in California that would dictate who can own the business.
Yeah, and I'll add two things. Number one is, as Michael was talking about, that ownership and supervision are two different things. And I will say this, California, for those that don't know, has probably the most restrictive medical board and attorney general's office in any other state, meaning like, if this is the law, this is what you have to follow. There's no leeway whatsoever in California. So that's the first thing to understand. And to your question is, there in other states, there's basically two ways that a nurse practitioner become independent. Number one, it's by license. So there are certain states, if you show up and you're licensed in that state, you're basically independent and you can own your own facility on day one. Other states, it's by education and training, meaning that you have to have the education, certain CME credits and other things of that sort, but then a certain number of years of actually being trained under that. So like states like Illinois or New York or Florida now, where those that it's not just by a flip of a switch, there's still a process you have to go through to gain that independence.
Got it. I think it's such a controversial issue. And sometimes people think that ownership is such a wonderful thing, but it's actually quite stressful and challenging to be a business owner and run a practice and do everything right medically for the patients too. So I foresee a bit of controversy arising from that, but hopefully we have practitioners who are going into it for all the right reasons and protecting the patient benefits. I've seen in California a rush of compounding pharmacies and practices doing weight loss semaglutide injections. And I know that there are legal boundaries and guidelines that we should be following. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think the very first thing to remember is that this is the practice of medicine. We've definitely seen in every state, entrepreneurs just trying to jump in there and open their own weight loss centers and skipping steps. So because it's the practice of medicine, you still need certain protocols and processes to follow. And the very first one is making sure either a physician, a nurse practitioner, or a PA has cleared that patient that they're a good candidate for those services. That's the very first step. And unfortunately, for some reason, in some states, some people just think, oh, it's just a weight loss drug. Let's just skip it, even though obviously you're injecting something, a substance, into someone either on or off label. The second piece is that there are some states that have gone further in. And I believe Mississippi was the first state to say that providing a semaglutide injection is outside the standard of care. And if you're either compounding it or if you're using it off label, I can only use the ones that are on label to use it, which right now is only one. And it's, as many people know, there's a shortage of it, which leads to the compounding piece, if you want to jump in on that piece.
Yeah. And so you get into the compounding, which is what everyone's doing. That's the mad rush, is that you can either, because there's a shortage, compounding is allowed for semaglutide. And so, there's an opportunity that people are striking on. And so to Brad's point earlier, this is the practice of medicine. And because of the way it works, pharmacy rules come into play. And so when you compound something, each state has its own variations to it. And what makes it challenging is everyone's trying to figure out, okay, is the patient going to inject this themselves at home, and how are we going to have a process that's protective to the patient and to the practice to do it that way? Or are we going to try to make this a great experience and bring the patient in, but then pharmacy rules kick in there, because how are you storing the product, and how are you holding a particular patient's prescription separate from the other prescriptions? And so there's a lot to unpack, and the pharmacy rules themselves is a pretty heavy conversation, and there's a lot going on in California right now that is that's impacting the ability to have this kind of, these kind of weight loss programs.
That's a great point, Michael. Is Dr. K, so there's a shortage of the actual drug you could buy. And then because of the way California's pharmaceutical board is interpreting certain rules, they're making even harder to ship in the ingredients you need to compound it. So it's added a whole new flavor of issues in the state of California.
So they become even more restrictive. It's harder to import the products that make up the compounding recipes.
Correct.
Right.
Yes.
So even more shortage. Are there any best practices if you are going to use a compounding pharmacy, or you're going to decide to do something off label?
I would say that the safest for everyone best practice is to, obviously you want to have a trusted pharmacy that's doing the compounding, and then prescribe it to be drop shipped to the patient. The practice, show the patient how to self-inject and give them training and a consent when they're at the office, and then allow them to do that there, because there's so many things that can go wrong with all the other ways. I mean, there's risk with that as well, with the self-injecting, but that seems to be the most appropriate way. And just as a with trying to keep this from putting everybody to sleep on the pharmacy rules, when you are putting a compound, when you're compounding inside of a medical practice, it raises a question. Can in that state, can a medical practice compound, or is it have to follow the pharmacy rules? And then can they dispense? And it just, it gets really messy. So that what's evolving, I think, is the best practice is the drop ship to the patient.
Yeah. And I'm going to add two things to that. Number one is, to Michael's point, is if you are allowing a patient to self-inject, it's very important, as anyone else, you would train them to understand how they're supposed to inject, when they're supposed to self-inject, having the proper consensus, as Michael said, as to that they understand they're going to have to self-inject. Secondarily, that to your other question is, if it's an off-label, you, the physician, that means the FDA didn't approve it for that particular utilization. However, as a physician, unless it's outside the standard of care, which in 49 states, you are allowed to use it for off-label now, Mississippi being our one exception, is then you need to make sure the patient realizes they're getting an off-label product. And that's also should be in the informed consent when speaking with that patient.
Interesting. Consenting is such a difficult process in general. We use so many products off-label, especially in aesthetics. It's sort of just part of the job that we are told a filler is properly FDA approved for one location, and then in practice you see it being used all over the face. Should we be putting this in our consent forms every single time that we're planning to use off-label use of a product in your face?
Yes.
The short answer is yes. Okay.
I mean, the easy answer is yes, and I'll tell you why. This morning I got a medical board complaint in Texas. And one of the things that it said was that they didn't realize they were getting an off-label use of a product. And good news is that they did inform this patient it was an off-label use, and it is in their consent. But it was just, again, a patient. For those who don't know, a patient can file any type of complaint. And then there's an informal letter, audience members, that's nothing informal about that letter. That they're asking for this physician to respond. This physician has already kind of given me the guidelines of what he did, the process they went through, and we have a copy of the record demonstrating that this patient was well aware that this is an off-label utilization of a particular drug. And that's why it's important, is because it's not going to happen to you right away. It's down the road where you have a patient file some complaint with either your medical board or a malpractice claim or just in general trying to cause trouble.
Yeah, I think we have to be so careful to protect ourselves as providers to give that information, because you'll go to meetings and lectures. Last night I was presenting at a meeting, and basically industry was recommending off-label use of their product by allowing all the speakers on the panel to talk about how they're using it, blah, blah, blah. And all these brand new injectors are going to go start doing the same thing and not even realize that they can get in trouble later for off-label use, because it's not in the generic consent form. So I think everyone listening should take a really good look at your consent forms. Every patient should read carefully, and every provider should add maybe that phraseology to it, that it may be used on label or off label.
And I would add, Dr. K, that for the physicians that are serving a quote medical director role where they're supervising someone, in every state, then that you need treatment protocols. That's how you're delegating these treatments to the various providers. And they need to, as part of their process, be delegating that, yes, it's within the standard of care, even though it's off label, to do these treatments in this way. That's protective to the doctor, because the doctor wants to know what these nurses are doing. And then secondly, protective to the nurses, that they're staying in their lane by following the things that the doctor has prescribed as here's the, kind of the step-by-step of how we do the various treatments.
Yeah,
exactly. But I mean, it's commonplace now to do masseter Botox injections, but guess what? None of the toxins are FDA approved for masseter use right now. And so all of us that are in practice need to really look closely at that, because industry is not going to step up and protect you when you get a claim against you for off-label use of these products. Now, Michael, you must have seen, the both of you have must have seen a million really bizarre cases and problems being reported to you. Do you have any recent ones that just kind of stand out as teaching opportunities?
Medical board type cases or
liability cases where a provider was found to be liable or doing something that really shouldn't have been done.
Trying to think, do you have one?
I mean, you can talk about what just happened here in Texas, and I can talk about.
I don't know, Dr. K, if you saw this. So, in Texas, all over the news.
This is not our client, though.
Yes, this is not our client. This is straight from the news. So, a esthetician / medical assistant here in Texas opened an IV hydration clinic in, and this summer, a patient died getting an IV.
My God.
In the last few weeks, this is the new hot news, is the physician who is the medical director had his license suspended. Wow. And so there's a lot of lessons to be learned from this. And I think what we talk about first and foremost is if you're taking on the role to supervise and delegate medical treatments, you can't just lend your license out. You cannot be an absentee physician because you will get the kitchen sink thrown at you if something bad happens to a patient. And so we kind of knew the moment you have something like someone dying that the spotlight was going to be really strong on this doctor and his license. And what we found, you know, from that is there was many cumulative things that made this kind of a bad scenario that showed that he wasn't really connected. They didn't have any form of written agreement with each other. He'd only been physically in this location twice ever or three times, small number of times. And he lived 120 miles away. And so what's interesting is you could take some of these little factors in isolation. And in Texas, you're like, you know what? It's actually not necessarily a problem that he was 120 miles away if he was immediately available by phone and you had all these other plan in place from a standard of care perspective. But you combine that with the fact that there was no good faith exam happening. This is a medical assistant, you know, that is putting stuff in an IV and treating someone, and then, you know, that's what caused the patient to pass away. You know, the fact that there was no initial exam of this new patient is not compliant and is a big problem. And then they take all these other factors to, bring it home.
Yeah. And that case, you know, that unfortunately is a situation where you often see where the board in this case wanted to protect the public and they immediately suspended this physician, didn't get a hearing. They felt like it was so out of bounds about what was happening there that they decided that this physician could no longer practice medicine. And it was not this physician's primary practice or primary location. So that's, to Michael's point, being very careful about being absentee. The opposite side of that, and when Michael and I first started speaking together on this, which goes over a decade now, you know, we would always talk about to physicians or nurse practitioners or PAs, hey, be real careful about protecting your license. I mean, you worked really, really hard to get your license. You know, here are the ways you get in trouble. And then to the non-licensed individuals, so the entrepreneurs, we'd say, like, worst case scenario, they could come and shut your business down. And so all the money and time and effort you spent, you know, your best day in front of a medical board is a cease and desist letter, meaning you got to stop immediately. But you could always do a corrective action later, which I won't bore your audience with all the corrective actions. And example I have that just happened this, again, this goes back to the summer. It must have been a hot summer. This happened in Florida. In Florida, for your audience to understand, anyone can own a medical entity in Florida. So anyone can own it. And in this particular case, he had an owner who had it. But she hired a physician who is not from America, which is not a problem. But he was not licensed in any states, a problem. And he was... and they were doing lasers and Botox with a medical assistant who had no formal licensing. So you had a non-physician owner with a unlicensed physician, because that's what this person was, because they weren't licensed in the state. And you had someone with no proper delegation. And again, going to Michael's point, no good faith exam, no clearance. There was no standard of care. they came in and arrested all three of these individuals. And, you know, they're, I won't say their names, but it's out there where all three were arrested. And she, this businesswoman, she had a very well-known spa and was growing very quickly, but skipped a lot of the steps that it appears to be, you know, your worst day normally would be medical board would have come in and shut them down. In this case, they were actually arrested for the unauthorized practice of medicine, which, yeah, by the way, for your audience to know, is that is a thing in almost every single state, and it is a felony.
Yeah, in California, too, I've heard cases of people being arrested on the spot.
Yeah.
They ask questions later, yeah, and rightly so. Like, you take an oath in this industry, in this profession, and patient trust is everything. And if it's all being undermined by dollars and profit and corner cutting, like, it's right for them to extinguish that as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and as the only thing I'll add to that, Dr. K, is generally speaking, when we see an arrest up until recently, it's because the person maimed and killed the person. And they were an unlicensed individual. And so therefore they got arrested for maiming the person or killing the person and the unauthorized practice of medicine. But yeah, as of lately, there've been more of those cases, to your point, where they, you know, I didn't see, at least in the Florida case, of any patient harm, but they actually went and arrested these individuals because they were practicing medicine without any proper supervision or delegation.
And there are certain states that are very, you know, crazy, like the wild, yeah, Amazon out there. Like, I was surprised to hear that Texas is one of them, that you don't need to be a medical professional to practice aesthetic medicine, that you can be, you know, you can just have a beauty degree.
And I think the best way to describe it is some states, I can think of like Virginia or Pennsylvania or Texas, the boards there say you, the physician or the ultimate decision maker, who is the best person to help take care of your patient, and does that person have the skill set to do it? And so they're putting a lot of leeway onto that physician, and then obviously putting that leeway on to the board so they can enforce it, meaning that, yes, if you're you know, Dr. K has me come in the office, here's my attorney, Mr. Brad here, and he's going to inject you, and my hands are shaking like crazy.
Don't do it, Dr. K.
Think twice.
Okay. Look how steady my hand is. But in California, to your point, you could not delegate that to me, because in California, anything that's medical has to be basically, generally speaking, sometimes LVN, but generally an RN and higher, is the only person that can treat and touch a patient. So it really is dependent on the state as about how much leeway you have.
It really is. And I guess all that leeway comes from years of having large communities in states that were underserved, that didn't have physicians, where you were using a lot of midwives or mid-level providers under supervision of a physician. But that was for basic primary care survival, like survival medicine, like your rural states need more doctors and we need more doctor extenders. But now in aesthetics, that makes no sense. Like, this is luxury goods. It does not make so much sense to me that we must have providers for Botox, for toxin, and they should have any level of training as long as the doctor thinks it's fine. I don't think that makes sense. Yeah. I understand the concept of, okay, maybe I have a trusted nurse that's worked with me for 20 years and she probably could do Botox better than everyone out there just because she's been in it for 20 years with me. But by the same token, that there's certain standards that I really feel that every state should incorporate at this point going forward, just for patient protection measures.
Yeah. And to your point, in states like Pennsylvania or Virginia or Texas, just because you can doesn't mean you should. And I know that our partner, Alex Tiersch, if he was sitting here, he has a very strong opinion that the vast majority of those medical services should never be performed by anyone below an RN. But with a lot of the service lines that are out there.
Exactly.
It's really confusing to the physicians because aesthetics is, to your point, is so new relative to medicine. And so they will call and say, you know, I'm interviewing this aesthetician. This would be a board certified plastic surgeon. And the good news is they call us to ask what they should do, but they'll say, aesthetician who's been injecting for 10 years wants to come work for me. And, you know, the way we pose it to them is to say, it's the, you can, if you're in Texas, in this example, he is in Texas, And I just said, this person has no formal anatomy training. So imagine a patient gets hurt and you're the one standing before the medical board justifying why you allow this person with this level, with no level of formal education, to, you know, inject this substance into a patient. And at that when they go through that mental exercise, that tends to help them realize, okay, yeah, this, I want someone that has, you know, the formal training in addition to, you know, the formal education and of course the training.
Yeah. And I'll tell you this, Dr. K, the confusion comes from, you know, that esthetician or whoever goes off to Vegas and they take a training course on injecting. So they're like, oh, I now have the skills to inject and therefore I can inject, or they learn how to fire a laser or whatever it is. And they get taught how to do it, but then they go to a state like California is a perfect example. An esthetician in California is not allowed to fire, to freeze the fat or burn the fat, either way, basically firing lasers, because the state there says that is the practice of medicine. Yet we know a lot of clients in California whose esthetician have been trained on it, and they show up and they want to fire these lasers, but they can't do it in that state. And that's the part where they have the skills, they've learned how to do it. And even maybe the doctor feels comfortable that, you know, freezing the fat is fine for this particular individual to do it. But the state says, no, that's the practice of medicine. Again, going back to California, RN or higher.
Interesting. Yeah, it's so important to ask yourself, Michael, like you said, those two questions, like, how would you answer to the judge if that case gets presented? Because that really makes you stop in your tracks. Like, how would you justify an answer to the judge? And also, would you let this person work on your mother or your sister? Like, those are kind of questions we have to ask ourselves.
I might steal that from you.
Yeah,
right. And then I think the consumer needs to be so wary, and it's so hard because there is no generalized accreditation resource that we can put a stamp of approval on anyone right now in aesthetics, other than board certification from certain societies. Like, how does the consumer even know? They're coming into a med spa that looks fancy and seems nice. Little do they know that the director is 200 miles away. Little do they know that the girl shooting up their face just took a class last weekend and they're like victim number five or the fifth person that's ever been touched by those hands. So how do you recommend for a consumer to feel more comfortable?
It's very tricky in, you know, the modernization of medicine with this retail elective feel where they're choosing to come in for this. And so you have an influx of all different types of licenses that want to open the business, and they don't stay in their lane and they start doing things that they're not licensed to do. Or you have private equity coming into the space, and they're oftentimes from a business perspective, they want to be compliant because they've got a lot of money invested, but they too don't know, you know, all the details, and they're trying to get things compliant. So to your question, if private equity with all the money is struggling with it, and, you know, the practitioners themselves don't know, how in the world is a consumer supposed to know? I think it's a really good question, one I haven't answered just because that it's not something that comes up in my normal practice. But I would say this: you definitely, if my mom was going to go to a med spa, going back to your question, I would want her to know, you know, who's the supervising physician involved. And if you don't see, you know, a physician anywhere, you know, on at some level of presence, then that should be a quick red flag. And then, you know, what types of practitioners are there? I mean, if you don't, an easy litmus test is if you show up somewhere and you're not getting a good faith exam, then they're not compliant, because almost everything in a medical spa setting is the practice of medicine, and you have to be cleared. So the example of the patient who died in Texas, it may not have ever happened if this doctor had been there and seen the patient history and prescribed what was to go in that IV, because apparently there was some medication in the IV that was what caused this reaction. And I know you, Brad, have a personal story with where the Good Faith Exam ended up saving someone's life in an IB situation.
Yeah, I have a client in Texas, actually based right off the Riverwalk, and she wanted to set it up. She's a RN, emergency room RN, but so she knows how to set these things up. And we walked her through how, although she knows how to take the history of an individual and physically examine them, and even in most states, RNs can actually start the IV line. That's all within their scope. They just can't put anything in it. And so we walked her through the compliant way of using telemedicine as a means. The physician came in via telemedicine. This person said they were hungover, drank too much the night before. And as they were progressing, and the physician was talking to him, watching this individual, because again, telemedicine, a lot of people think it's telephone. This is actually, most states, it means video medicine. Maybe I should change it to video medicine. But point being is that besides the utilization of the telemedicine, while they're visiting, he's like, I don't think you're hungover. I think you're suffered a heart attack. And I think based on everything I'm reading, I think you're about to get another one. And again, this gentleman happened to be an emergency medicine physician and said, you know, two blocks from where you are is an emergency room. You need to go immediately. And lo and behold, he was having a heart attack. And the RN, she calls me later and tells me the whole story. She's like, I would not have known any of that. I just thought he looked really hungover and he was sweaty. And he just maybe didn't catch all the signs because I didn't notice those things. And so to her, she was the proper way of doing these things by having that physician clear the patient and then realizing, no, the IV is not going to help in this case. It's actually a lot worse.
Well, that's a good example of where we can do things correctly. With the onset of the telemedicine or FaceTime, are there any particular considerations or rules to protect ourselves in engaging with patients? You can't diagnose everything by FaceTime.
That's a great question. And there's couple different things. Number one, any type of, so there's so many different platforms. So there's EMR softwares that have video, you know, there's Zoom, there's FaceTime, whatever component you're using. The first thing you need to know is how secure is it? Have you gone through the process to make sure? So I can use Zoom as example. If you're lining up your patients that day to do the Zoom calls with each one, each patient needs to have their own exact code, because you don't want to have a patient hop in and join you because they got there early or you went over. So just from a security protocol, there's a process you go through to make it at the highest level. That's the first thing. The second thing, though, is to your point, Dr. K, is that which is important is when you're using telemedicine, you have to use basically the exact same standard of care as if you were in the room with them. So if you need to physically lay your hands on someone to make that diagnosis, yes, you cannot use telemedicine. We have a client that has a laser center, and he had told me once that he likes to touch the skin to see how it responds before he recommends the type of setting. Well, of course, he can't do that. He has to put his hands on it. He can't have someone else touch it to see how they respond. So that would be one of those types of services that if the patient was coming in for that, he or the nurse practitioner PA that he delegated to would have to be the individuals who utilize it. So it's not a tool that you can use all the time, but where people get in trouble is one, they use the telephone. We have a case on that one that blew up because they were prescribing drugs and using telephone, and that's not sufficient. Or they use the telephone and receive texts, and they go, oh, but I got the text pictures of what the person looked like. No, if you read the rule, it has to be audio and visual where we can see each other simultaneously so that you can ask me questions. And especially in the world that you're living in, you want to see their skin tone. You want to see how they respond to your questions. You want to be able later on, to Michael's point, when you go in front of the board saying, no, I walked them through that and they were comfortable with that and they understood why that was an important element or whatever the reason why. You're using telemedicine.
And you, a couple of additional notes. You want the patient to consent to telemedicine as part of it. And then the second thing is that telemedicine is governed by state law.
Yes.
So from a lawyer perspective, where a practice could get in trouble is when they have a patient in another state and they're doing telemedicine from their state. You're practicing in the state of the patient potentially. There's a lot of variables. It gets pretty fact dependent, pretty quickly, but we would definitely encourage people to make, if they're doing telemedicine with people, you know, across state lines, that there's some
major
issues
red
to
flags.
Cover.
Yeah. Yes.
Interesting. So we're going to have to screen them for where do you live before we telemedicine with you.
Exactly. That's part of the consent.
That's part of that consent. And and it gets confusing because obviously you're in California and then your patient, you know, is vacationing in Wyoming. And so I have doctors like, oh my gosh, can I even talk to them? I'm like, no, there's a ton of exceptions. If you have a pre-existing relationship with that patient, you've already established that doctor-patient relationship, and they happen to be traveling and they calling you for whatever, you know, hey, I'm having this issue, Dr. K. Yes, you're absolutely allowed to talk to them on the telephone or video conference with them. It just means that if they're in Wyoming and they want to continue treatment, it's past whatever the scope that you had, you can't continue to treat them when you haven't seen them since then. So that's all of a sudden they move to Wyoming and you continue to treat them. You better have a Wyoming license, because if there is an issue and they report it, they're going to report it to the Wyoming board, who's going to report it to the California board. So again, that's where Michael says it starts getting complicated.
Yeah. There's a lot of our clients operate on patients from out of state. The patients go back home. There's a little bit of leeway for post-op.
Yes.
Where you can kind of have post-op care. But there is a crossing over point to mm-hmm. Brad's point where it's something new and so you have to be careful.
Right.
Interesting. Talk to me a little bit about social media and where you've seen practices get into trouble with incorrect social media practice.
Yeah. So the from a compliance perspective, the false and misleading element is the biggest risk. So you know, there it's a competitive world, and you know, people will do things to get a competitive advantage. It may be as subtle as using different lighting for before and after photos. Mm-hmm. It may be something as innocent as using, you know, industry kind of approved mass advertising. And because of the relationship with industry, they get to participate in co-advertising opportunities. And there might be models on there that depicts, you know, use this, you know, procedure, and it might make the patient feel like if they do that, they're going to look like this model. And many states require disclosure if you have a model. And so the practice may not even know to think that, because they're just piggybacking on this advertising opportunity. Yet the medical board regulates medical advertising, and they're protecting the patient from anything that's would be considered false and misleading.
Yeah, and great points, Michael. Is understand for your audience, there's the Federal Trade Commission can also, which is the federal government, if you're doing something that's false, deceptive, or misleading, they can actually go after your advertising under the federal guidelines. Most of the time, it's the medical boards that you're dealing with, and almost everyone has every single state we've looked at has almost the exact same concept, which is false, deceptive, misleading. And that can be where you hire some outside third party to come in to help build out your new website, to build out your social media posts, and they're helping produce this, and they don't have a background in medical. And they're like, wow, look at these great pictures off Dr. K's site. I'm going to grab some there. Or look at these great sites off Dr. Bob's site. I'm going to grab there. And all of a sudden they're pulling images off other people's sites because it looks good. And they don't realize that, number one, that's a huge no-no. It's, you know, violating copyright laws, et cetera. But number two, that is also false, deceptive, misleading. And this weekend, I had two different people come up to me and approach me and tell me that they found out that someone was using their images across the country for their social media and on their websites. And one was this plastic surgeon's wife, facelift, and he was quite mad to find out that someone else was utilizing, number one, images. And on that, where the second place where people get in trouble, Dr. K, is you need to have proper consents from your patients. Although ultimately the images are owned by the medical practice because that's part of your chart and you're the medical record custodian of them, the patient ultimately has the right to say yes or no on when and how you use those images, those before and after. So going back to our consent talk, which everyone seems to like so much, but on that patient consent, it should be very clear that you, if you plan to use those before and after pictures, patients should say, yes, you can use it on your website. You can use it for research and you can use it for educational purposes and social media. And you can use it, Dr. K, on both your practice's site and on your own personal site. So again, we like a more robust patient consent that's very clear on all the different ways it can be used.
And you raised, Brad, a point, Dr. K, that is a third area that's a risk factor for practices with the way things are happening in the modern, you know, med spa world today or medical practice world. And that is a lot of providers, whether they're doctors, RNs, PAs, et cetera, they have their own social media following when they join a practice. And so, you know, it's a big deal to them to keep that following. And so there's business discussions that have to happen with the practice of, okay, well, how are we going to handle this from a business? Cause I want to build up, you know, the following of my practice and protect that. But there's also HIPAA related issues, because if, you know, you hire an RN injector to a practice and they have a big following and they do an injection and then they post that to their before and after, and that's that individual, they have not, the patient hasn't consented to that individual RN, kind of to Brad's point, then there's now technically a HIPAA violation that's happened. Yeah.
Very important to specify that when you hire people. And it's kind of interesting how the law is going to keep changing like this, because you don't think about it. You think that it's all going to stay within your practice. It becomes a work product asset to your practice, and it shouldn't leave your practice. You should definitely define that with your injectors before, ahead of time, because if they leave the practice and all that work leaves with them, then what's good? What's the good of the overhead you're paying? So I think that's super important. Are we liable for people? Like, I, of course, consent my patients thoroughly for social media, and I do a lot of it. If someone reposts their image on their page, I realize it's escaped beyond my HIPAA control because it was allowed to be posted on my page. Am I responsible for that?
No. So if it's the patient who's doing it, it's their right to use that image however they want. Patient can always disclose.
Like if another injector sees my page and thinks this is such a great post, and then they repost my post on their page.
You would want to tell them to cease and desist from utilizing that information immediately, because it's not theirs to use.
Well, I want to make sure. I think you're just, are they sharing your post or
sharing our post? I mean, I've had everything happen where people steal my work and put their name on top of my work, which is absolutely wrong. And then I will make them cease and desist, or they're just educationally resharing.
Yeah. Reshares. I have not seen this come up, but reshares would normally be fine because it's part of the social media where they're posting and resharing it. And obviously they're giving credit back to where it started, which is on your social media platform that you get to use it. I've not seen a complaint that any board has taken up with that says, well, I posted it on, you know, Facebook and then it got reshared, you know, 10,000 times. Well, that person didn't know that, you know, using that social media that could happen. So I haven't seen that come up.
Yeah, I think that's probably fine.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And then talk about patients posting bad reviews. So it's happened to every practice. It's very, really disturbing to see people give you a very negative review. And then that opinion is out there in the world, whether it's truth, fiction, or competitive sources, we don't know. But it's very hard to edit and remove. Do you have any advice on what to do when those things come up, and if it's possible to protect your reputation?
Yeah, well, the first thing, obviously, anyone who's ever got a negative review, it's very triggering because, you know, you work so hard at building up a good brand. And when you see that, for whatever reason, if you could have, you know, 5,000 great reviews, you have one negative review, for whatever reason, your eyes lock in on that one negative review. That's just the human, well, at least for me, it's the type A personality. I think that's just our human nature. It's like, why don't you love me? Love me. But when it really, when you take a step back is, as hurtful as that is a couple things. I used to say, and I'll let you come in and talk about the second part of it. I used to tell someone, just ignore it. The more you respond to it, the more social media, the SEO engines might build upon that if you're having a back and forth with the person, that could be a problem. So I used to tell people not to respond at all. And none of my physicians like that answer. So luckily I found someone much smarter than me who really dove much deeper into this and really build a plan as to how to better respond to when you get a negative review. And I'll let you jump in on that one.
Yeah, he's alluding to me as the smarter person.
Audience members, I am not.
I tried to steal that. Now, our partner, Jeff Siegel, who spent his entire career handling the patient relationship, he has shown us the light yes. on kind of a best practice here. So I'll say this, it's kind of implied with Brad's answer, but to be clear, the challenge for you in engaging it is that it can be a HIPAA violation to acknowledge the patient is your patient. So they can say all these things, and you, by saying something that acknowledges them as a patient, can be a HIPAA breach. And of course, if they're mad, you know, that accelerates that risk. Mm-hmm. It's actually a breach if they say something good and you acknowledge them. It's just not likely that they're going to do anything if they're happy. With the risk changes when they're mad. But what Jeff showed us is that there is something about, you know, responding that innately people want. And what he encourages is a one-time response that's not responding to the patient, but is really a public service announcement to the broader world that's reading it, that is deftly drafted so that you're not saying that you're acknowledging this person as a patient. You don't acknowledge the person, but you can say things like, the practice believes patient safety is A, B, and C, and here's the data for A, B, whatever the circumstances, that is a one-time get in, say what you have to say, get out. And so there's something else out there that gives some context to mm-hmm. someone who 6 months later is going through the reviews and sees that mm-hmm. horrible review.
Yeah. And I'll add a couple different things to that. A lot of times the practice knows who this person is. And they are one of the things you can do is try to take the conversation offline and try to be really nice to this person and see if there's a way you can work through that. We definitely have had practices like, oh, I know Bob was mad and, you know, he thought we did something and we just ignored his call and we should have called him back, and they call him back and all the patient wanted to be was heard. Now, there are some crazy patients that, you know, they'll never be heard because you'll never meet them where they are because they'll never have met expectations as to what they want to look like afterwards. So those are the people that you don't want to treat anyway. But the second part is, if someone's looking at your website and they see this negative review and they see this educational response, and then after that, that same negative review has 10 or 12 other responses from that same patient, what do you think most people are going to see? Wow, there's a negative review. The practice had a very reasonable educational response, and the patient just keeps posting and posting and posting. They're going to think that the patient's a little bit on the loony side and that the practice seemed very reasonable. Or you, the practice, come out and go blasting and you file a lawsuit against them, which unfortunately we know of more than one plastic surgeon who's filed suits against their patients for filing negative reviews. And there's a whole bunch of laws that does not favor you as a plastic surgeon to doing that. But how do your patients feel like, oh my gosh, if I had a bad experience and I had to post a negative review, I'm going to get sued by that doctor? I don't think I want to go see that doctor. So you have to think, you know, 5, 6, 7 moves later. And one of our good friends always says the solution to pollution is dilution, meaning that have a system that helps capture the good reviews. If you want to have that one educated response, that one negative review, then keep moving forward and don't let that negative review own you. And you start thinking about it every day and every night.
That's so interesting that no physician has kind of challenged the old constitutionality of Yelp. I mean, if I'm a doctor and I can't acknowledge or disacknowledge or any patient because I'm incriminating myself HIPAA-wise, either way, how fair is that? That seems so crazy.
I know. Yeah. Well, one of the things Jeff had told us, it's an interesting story to kind of bring home the strategy here, is he talks about the Streisand effect.
Yes.
And so... There's that story of, you know, some rogue photographer took pictures of Barbara Streisand's house, created a website, and like no one had seen it, but it happened. And then I guess her camp found out about it. They sued and the suit became public. And then the website had, you know, a gazillion people visiting it. So just the fact that you responded and engaged and went after it actually creates more attention than if you just, you know, kind of get in and get out and move on.
Yeah. And I'll add one more thing, Dr. K, is I know that our partner has had success when you can prove that this patient was not yours. There are certain ways in which he has had Yelp and other sites take down negative reviews. One of our favorite stories on this one is the practice has not opened yet. And then the competitor down the road started dumping all these negative reviews. And they were able to say, it's impossible to have all these negative reviews of these people we treated since we haven't even started practicing yet. So Yelp did take those down.
That's so crazy. I know I got slammed on Yelp when I posted something about supermodel Chrissy Teigen and her, the overfilled face and wood injector. I didn't even say anything about her face, but her picture was there and her fans came for me on Yelp. And I was like, I haven't even met any of these people. They're all strangers and they're knocking down my Yelp. So that took a lot of work. So I think we're so vulnerable in so many ways. And in a lot of ways, Yelp can be used as blackmail patients all the time. Unfortunately, some of them are unscrupulous enough to ask for money back, or else I might be wanting to post a, you know, a review. So oh, yeah. There's not really an easy way to deal with that, I guess.
It's messy for sure.
It is. It is. Are there any ways that we can stay up to date with local regulations and guidelines in terms of just being on top of this? Do you guys have a newsletter?
We do. Yeah. So you, anyone in the audience can go to birdadotto.com and subscribe to our newsletter that comes out once or twice a month, I think.
Yes.
But it has, we have information that's pushed out monthly. And
then we have a weekly podcast that we every Wednesday that's released that actually has educational material. So it'll be Michael and I with some awesome doctor like Dr. K will join us, or Michael and I telling stories about things that we've saw and happened and what's going on to try to keep things up to date. And then, of course, one of our sister organizations and spa that's out there, that they produce a lot of information. But you're right. It's hard to keep up. Luckily, we have one attorney who basically full time is that's his job to keep up with all the different stuff. And then because of our clients being coast to coast, we learn about a lot of things that are happening. And that forces us to keep up to, you know, how do they stay compliant in New York or Florida or wherever it is because of what's happening in each state.
It's such a quickly evolving industry. Aesthetics has new products, new frontiers every month, every week. So I think that's critical that you guys help keep us up to date. Is artificial intelligence going to somehow impact the legal aspect of aesthetic medicine?
We actually did a podcast. Our podcast is the Legal 123s with Bertadotto on AI. I think it will. We don't know quite yet how it will. I mean, here's our concern with AI is in the legal realm is that it will be able to create at some point a good legal contract or a legal document. What is the principle that we learn in our first year of law school with contract law? Is the goal of a contract is what they call meeting of the minds. In other words, if you and I enter into an agreement, the best thing that can come from that is that we're on the same page because of the conversations that we have going through it. And so AI is just an advancement of things we've seen during our career, like LegalZoom and all these things that will spit out documents. And if that's all that happens, it causes chaos because it's not forcing the two people that are or more that are entering in the contract to connect and make sure that they're on the same page expectations wise as to how things are going to work. And it gets more important in healthcare because healthcare is so heavily regulated that you may have a contract that ChatGPT spits out that's perfect from a contract form perspective, but if you're doing things differently than what the contract says, you could go all the way to potential jail time or significant fines because you have to be doing what the contract says you'll be doing.
Yeah. And on the medical side, What's fascinating is ChatGPT is actually getting stupider, which I think it's just, it's pulling in so much information that it's hard for, and actually on the legal side too, by the way, it's hard for certain circumstances where it doesn't really understand the diagnosis it's giving. So there was a situation where they ChatGPT was helping answer questions for a weight loss clinic. And basically it was telling bulimic people to stop eating as much. So it's not smart enough to understand all the implications of what it's going through and how it's going through.
But I agree. It's very basic. I had it generate questions for our podcast and I was like, these questions suck and they're not interesting. So you can tell they're written by ChatGPT. I turned to my assistant and I said, this is ChatGPT. I need intelligent questions. Well, you guys have been awesome. I can't wait to see you at the next meeting. And I hope we do get to do a panel together at AmSpa. I think it'll be fun to bring that kind of interactivity to the stage. Where can people find you on the gram and your various social handles?
I think Brad's pointing to me because he's a social media dinosaur.
What?
Bertadotto.com and at Bertadotto Law is our social media handle.
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. Well, I look forward to
very active in all of them.
Seeing you at the next meeting. I can't thank you enough for the information. I feel like this is this should be the backbone of everything we're doing when we're setting up our practices and we're looking to serve patients better. And I hope everyone learned so much. I know I did. Thank you for having me, guys. Yes, of course.
Grateful. Thank you.
I'm sure I'm going to have more questions. We'll have to do a follow-up podcast sometime soon. That's it for now, guys. Thanks for finding me on our podcast, Beauty Bites. It's here every Tuesday and Friday. We do a 5-minute Friday. You can find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, D-R-K-A-Y. And our website is the same, beautybydrk.com. That's where we have all of our amazing skincare line. That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.